You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, episode number 233. Do research. Feed your talent. Research not only wins the war on cliche, it's the key to victory over fear and its cousin, depression. Robert McKee.
Broadcasting from a dark, windowless room in Hollywood, when we really should be working on that next draft, it's the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, showing you the craft and business of screenwriting while teaching you how to make your screenplay bulletproof. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. Well, guys, today on the show, we have writer-director H. Alberto. And H. is the director of the new film, Aristotle and Dante Discover the Secrets of the Universe, which is world premiering at the Toronto Film Festival this year. Now, H. and I had a fantastic conversation about how she was able to get her career off the ground, how she was able to get the rights to this best-selling book, how she was able to get Lin-Manuel Miranda as a producer, how she attracted Eva Longoria and legendary actor Eugenio Deberes, and so much more. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with H. Alberto. I'd like to welcome to the show H. Alberto. How are you doing, H.?
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. We were having a good laugh before we got started because there's few of us Cuban filmmakers in the business. There are Cuban filmmakers without question, but every time I find another Cuban filmmaker, I get very excited and we start talking and we start like la 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 la, and then of course you're from Miami and I'm from
Miami. Very Cuban of you. The la 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 la
la la la la, but tú sabes qué es eso, ¿cuándo sabes?
I love it. It is like a rarity. We are out here and we are doing the thing, but there's not many of us. So especially like a Cuban from Miami, because there's Cubans everywhere, but like a Cuban everywhere. From Miami is specific. And being from Miami is very specific too.
So, mm-hmm. Especially, and being filmmakers from Miami is like a whole other conversation. It's
absolutely. I feel like I've heard your name from like years down the line and I refuse to age myself, but like, you were in the sphere of like Dave Rodriguez and like Caroline.
Stop it. Why are you going back that far?
Yes, I know. But like Dave directed my first short.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
You were in that short?
It was, and I also wrote that short.
Oh my God.
May he rest in peace.
May David rest. I did push for him. I did push for him. And then that was when I released my first short film, Broken, back in the day.
I've seen Broken back in the day. Like, I've seen that movie because he did Push. And then like while Push was in post, he fit in my short and I found him off like Craigslist. I had written the script. It was all like shift left on like a Word doc. I was really young and it was a really beautiful experience. But I remember your name from then because I have a sick memory.
This is the first lesson that we'll teach in this conversation. It is a small, small world.
Absolutely. And it's an even smaller industry. I say that LA is like the biggest, smallest town in the world.
I mean, my God, I can't believe, like, you took me way back. This is, we're talking about early 2000s. last year. But yeah. So my first question to you, H, is how did you get into and why did you want to get into this business?
That's a very loaded question. I have a very interesting upbringing being from Miami and growing up. When I grew up, my father was in the drug trade and was a fugitive for a really long time. And it was 8 years and we lived on the run with him. And movies were always my escape. So it was sort of like the thing that brought me comfort. And like, I never asked for toys. I wasn't like big on anything else. I was obsessed with movies. I just didn't know that you could have a career on all facets and all sides of the film industry. So I acted for a really, really long time.
Wow. That's so, when is the movie coming out of when you were on the run? I mean, there's a movie there, I have to believe.
It's a TV show, and we are, yes, it's somewhere. I can't say that. It's being developed right now and it's written, and it's like the thing that, it's probably the most honest piece of writing that I ever did. It healed me in so many ways. It was cathartic. It like sent me on my journey of my transition. It was, it just like unlocked so much to revisit like a version of myself that always existed, but sort of like life happens and you don't know how to sort of embrace that and be everything that you could be. But that script got me to the Sundance Episodic Lab. It got me my first TV writing job, my second TV writing job, and sort of like helped me get me where I am right now to be able to make the film that we're about to talk about.
That's amazing. That's, I mean, well, I'm looking forward to seeing that series because, I mean, being from Miami, I did just see Cocaine Cowboys again. That's just...
So it's very that. It's like, that was my life. So,
wow. Yeah. And you were on the run with him. With your family?
Yeah. I mean, it was a very like interesting experience. And I thought it was completely normal until you like grow up and you're like, wait, you didn't have that experience.
You weren't running away from the cops and the FBI? And
exactly.
The
it's also like deep trauma, which, you know, thank God for therapy. Of course.
Right. So, I could only imagine. I can only imagine. Well, that makes sense. I guess. So in other words, movies were your refuge and you were able to kind of go into that world and very Cinema Paradiso-esque.
Yeah. I love that film.
It's such a great film. Just to kind of escape into movies. I always used to say that movie theaters were like a church for me. I would go into it and by myself, I would just go to a movie and just in the middle of Tuesday at 1 o'clock or something and just sit there and watch a movie. And by the time I was done watching that movie, my life has been better for whatever reason. I would have forgotten the problems I was dealing with in high school or whatever.
The one thing that I like missed during the pandemic, as a writer, I'm great at isolating and like quarantine didn't scare me, but I missed the escape of going to a theater in the middle of the day. And it was always one of my favorite things. My grandmother would take me when I was really young and she would like skip movies with me and like she'd fall asleep in all of them. But like she was my like road dog and going to see all these movies that I did. Often seeing movies that I shouldn't have been seeing at the age that I was. Like Leaving Las Vegas, I saw when I was 10 years old.
Oh my God.
And I went home and wrote my first script on line paper.
That is amazing. Wow. I mean, I saw Beverly Hills Cop when I was like 7 or 8, and I thought that was a little rough. But Leaving Las Vegas, it's rough for an adult, let alone a 10-year-old, for God's sake.
I mean, but when you're on the run and you're slightly traumatized and growing up faster than you need to, sex is no big deal.
I mean, what? Leaving Las Vegas, what? A drunk killing himself? It's fine. Sorry for spoiler alerts. If you haven't seen it, it's on you guys. Sorry. So you mentioned that you got into Sundance. How was that experience? Because I've spoken to many people who've gone through that lab and through that process. And I'd love to just kind of get the inside feeling of what it was like being in there and going through that process.
I loved it. It was one of the most nurturing experiences that I've had as a writer and a filmmaker thus far in my career. And it just like, I was introduced to so many people. It was affirming in so many ways. It was such a goal of mine to like be validated by Sundance, because I didn't go to film school. I don't have any formal training. Like I taught myself by reading scripts and watching movies at the same time. So like, but I knew that I knew what I was doing, right? Because I loved it so much. And like, I worked so hard at it that like having that validation through that program was really invaluable. And there I met like Lee Eisenberg, who gave me my first writing job on Little America season 2, and Latoya Morgan, who I just wrote on a show with her for HBO Max called Duster, which is also created by J.J. Abrams as well.
That's not bad. That's not bad. That's good networking.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Not bad. Not bad. If you can get it, if it's a good work, if you can get it.
And I also think that like who I am, what my perspective is, there's like definitely room for me now. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of like hard work and timing is what worked in my favor.
Timing's big with everything, man. Especially in the film industry. Like, you know, when I talk to some of these guys who are coming up in the 90s, who are the legendaries, the Robert Rodriguez's and the Richard Linklaters and these kind of people, you know, Rick was the first one to tell me, he's like, I mean, Slacker wouldn't make it today. Like, there's just no place for a movie like that today. It'd be difficult. Yeah. It'd be an art movie. He calls them backyard movies. And he was like, that's literally his backyard. Austin was his backyard back then. And then I watched it recently. And now that I live in Austin, it's changed a bit. The city has changed just slight bit since then.
But I love Austin. My lead actor in my film is from Austin and I went to visit. I've been a couple of times and I absolutely love it. So good for you for escaping Miami.
Yes, absolutely. No, it's wonderful here. I absolutely love it here. Now, you also directed and wrote a lot of short films I saw in your filmography. What was that? How did that help you develop as a filmmaker? Because a lot of people are like, shorts, you shouldn't do it, this or that. How did it work for you and your path?
Well, I had the foundation of acting, which I think was also invaluable to, you know, not only directing actors, but understanding story in a way that was very specific. Mm-hmm. But the shorts were sort of my, like, I could do this. It was giving myself permission and not waiting for permission from anybody to just boots on the ground, do it. And like, I didn't know what I was doing, but I knew that the only way I was going to learn and get better was actually like making something. So that's how that happened. And then it really became, you often, when you're in those positions, you think you need to like scale up or have like the ambitions of working or collaborating with people that are further ahead in your career. But what I found to be most useful is that I was collaborating with people that were right next to me, that were my contemporaries that have come up with me. So we were learning in so many ways together. Luckily, like those films got seen at film festivals and stuff, but like had they not, that would have been okay too, because like I, again, not going to film school, that was my film school.
And like Robert Rodriguez, he had 25, I think, shorts that no one ever saw before he made Mariachi.
That's crazy. Yeah, I wasn't about to make 25 shorts.
But you did a lot though. I mean, you did what, like 10 or 12 at least?
In variations of it. Yeah.
Yeah. But it was an experience even just being on a set, especially when you're coming up. Exactly. That was so much.
100%. So that I'm grateful for those experiences. And I think everybody should make a short.
Absolutely. I mean, I started my career off with shorts and it did well for me without question. Now, your first film, Harakiri. Harakiri or Harakiri?
It's Harakiri.
Harakiri.
Yeah.
I was watching it and
I'm like cringing because it's like one of those films that I can't believe is out in the world. Sorry, Alex.
Look, the thing I like about it is it has a very mumblecore vibe to it. It's very Duplass, Swansburg, Lynn Shelton kind of vibe to it. So how did it come about and how did you even get that film off the ground? Because it's shot very naturalistic. It looks like it's available lighting. But there's a really great story behind it. And you could start seeing through the cracks, like, oh, I see.
Yeah, there's a voice somewhere in there. I call that film an experiment. It premiered at the New Orleans Film Festival and was seen. Yeah. It got distributed through Breaking Glass. So yeah. It's trippy to me that it even saw the light of day. Obviously, that's like, in hindsight, I thought I was like groundbreaking.
Obviously. No. This is, you know? Hollywood will now see my genius.
Exactly. Like, this is it. I'm doing it on my own. I wanted to make a Dogma film, like a Lars von Trier Dogma 95 movie, which is impossible to make, especially like now. So it was an idea that I had. And I just had an outline and I found really good actors, often friends, that were game to play. I had a camera and a boom mic and we were out on the road. And just, we shot that in 2 days for like $2,000.
Amazing. Amazing. Yeah. And that wasn't that far, that wasn't that long ago. Like, because the mumblecore movement, and I use the mumblecore movie. I know what Dogma 95 is, but the mumblecore movement was in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
And this film was within 7 or 8 years ago, if I'm not mistaken, right?
What? I don't even remember.
It's like 2015. I mean, at least that's what I thought. The 2012. Anyway.
2015. Yeah, that sounds right. 2015 sounds right.
Yeah, 2015. Exactly. So it wasn't like it was that far back ago. And you were doing that kind of filmmaking. And look, my first film was mumblecore-esque, which I did the exact same thing on my first. These last two features I did were completely outlined, shot like it, one was 8 days, one was 4 days. You just roll and you're like, let's see what happens.
You make it. Yeah, you just do it. And it's like at the end of the day, it's playing. Right. And so it's probably one of those films that I could have kept for myself. But
you distributed it. You distributed it worldwide.
Yeah, I mean, it was.
But did you do well, by the way, on it? I mean, it cost $2,000. So did you make any money on it?
I made money on it.
Look at that. You are a successful filmmaker. You're a successful filmmaker.
I was like, this is it. This is the beginning. And it was like huge in Germany. It had like a theatrical screening and everything in Germany. It was like
you can't walk the streets in Germany, can you?
Oh, I mean, I've changed gender since, so maybe I'll get away with it. But like it's interesting because the DVD of the German version of the movie is very graphic. So I think that has a lot to do with why it was a success. I'm telling you way too much. The Cuban from Miami thing really worked for you.
I've done a few of these. So on that film, though, I have to ask you, since it was your first film and it was an experiment, what was the biggest lesson you learned in that entire process?
That you need a crew.
You need money, a crew, and a script.
Money, you'll never have enough money, but you definitely need a crew and people that are really good at their job because they make you look good.
That's very, very true, without question. Now, you mentioned that you're working on that on the show Duster with JJ. I mean, I'm assuming you've met JJ and you're working with JJ. Like, what's it like working with someone like JJ? Because he's such a legend in our business, and he's been doing it at a high level for so long and doing television. I could just list off the shows I've watched of his. So in the television space, what's it like working on a JJ Abrams created show?
JJ Abrams is a legend as a human as well. We worked together often. He was in the room often. Before we went into production, we had like an hour-long conversation about the film as well. I consider him like a mentor in so many ways in a very short amount of time. But what I learned the most from him was his kindness. He's so capable of listening and being present and actually caring despite his creative genius. And that to me was something that... I hope to emulate as my career goes on. And if it ever comes near what JJ is, just the fact that he is so successful and he's worked on such strong and like popular IPs and was able to maintain this humanity, that to me was very impressive. And I mean, like, he's all over the place and he's doing too much, but it's also like what fuels him.
Right.
And I was just in awe of him. From like a real, like I also wasn't impressed by him, and that's why we became friends.
Right. You didn't geek out, but you are internally impressed by him, but you weren't like, oh my God, it's JJ. Like you weren't completely fangirling.
Well, I think like I was like, he's a regular dude who is really good at what he does and has a real passion for it. Like I think that's how everybody should approach these people. You know what I mean? Like I could be JJ, you could be JJ, like anybody could be JJ. It just takes like a certain level of tenacity and perseverance and passion to sort of like want that.
Right. Without question. And I mean, I saw him coming up and he started off in television and I know he wanted to do features and he loved Spielberg. And then he got to work with Steven on things. And, you know, then he gets to do Star Wars and, you know, he's done okay.
Pretty rad. I really fuck with JJ in a real way.
So that TED talk he did. With the box. Oh,
I don't know if I've ever seen
that. Oh, you have to watch that. It's a TED talk he did about a box. It's his like creative muse in so many ways. It's a box that he was given as a child and he's never opened it. And it's like this, and it's like what's inside. And it's like this magic box. And it's fascinating. It's like a 10 minute lecture he does about creativity, but he uses the box and he brought the box out and everything. It's great.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
So I was a lot of that on a daily basis. And he talks about all these toys and, like, you know, a listening in device when he was a kid. And it's just like super eight. Every time he talked, like, I would have visions of that film because it was so autobiographical and so real to his experience that I was, it's really sweet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can see the tenderness and the humanity in his work, just like you see it in Spielberg's work. Like, you can see it in E.T., you can see it in Schindler's List. You can see the humanity that comes through their work, and it's something you can't fake.
No, you can't. And that was something that, like, was really important to me to also implement in making this film, because mm-hmm. I think it was like a redefinition of Latino, Latina, Latine, Latinx stories. I just want to make sure everybody's included.
I know, right?
Yeah. Like the entire alphabet. But it's a redefining of that, because so often, like, our films about our experience are violent or just stereotypical and playing into tropes, and even about the queer experience as well. Mm-hmm. So I really wanted to make something that felt all American and accessible to everyone. This was just, at least from my experience, like, the duality of being, like, growing up Cuban, but also being American was something that really inspired me, because it's like, you feel both, but you are one, right? So, right. And that's it was risky for people to sort of understand what I was trying to do, because I don't think they have any, like, sort of relatable movies or comps that have done that before, because it's just so about the immigrant experience or about this just one narrative. And so, like, I'm hoping that this unlocks an understanding to that, which is rooted in humanity and compassion.
Without question. So we're talking about your new film, Aristotle and Dante Discover the Secrets of the Universe, which is
I've done this before too. Did you see how I segued for you?
Did you see how that worked? It was very, it's very professional. It's very, very, very slick of you. No, of course. And I just watched it, and it's beautifully done. It is hypnotic in certain scenes. It's extremely touching, and there's a humanity that we're talking about in it. And I mean, the cast is fantastic, and Henio and Eva and everybody else, the leads, so beautifully done, but it's done with such a subtle hand, is what I noticed in your work in this film, because it's not heavy-handed and it's not preachy. It's human. And it does that make sense?
Yes, that's exactly. I'm just letting you talk because that's exactly what I want someone to say about the film, right? Like, sure, it's about this, like, kid's coming of age who's, like, grappling with his identity and his sexuality and all of these things. But it's so much more than that, right? It's like, how does your family and your experience and your circumstances influence that experience, right? Like, how do you go through the journey of trying to be who your parents want you to be and who your soul calls you to be? And how is their trauma affecting your sort of the way you navigate the world, right? So it was, I think the subtlety was necessary in sort of, like, presenting that in a naturalistic way that slowly, like, evolved throughout it.
Yeah, it's beautifully done. And I have to give you props for working with a new, young, and up and coming unknown producer by the name of Lin-Manuel Miranda. I've never heard of him. Is he doing anything good?
No, I mean, like, he begged me to be a part of this. So it was, I can't get rid of him now.
Now it's like he's blowing up my phone on a daily basis. Like, hey, what do you think? Hamilton 2? Should I do it?
We Zoomed yesterday. No, I think, he is a force. And he had done, I read the book in 2014. I read it in one sitting. It unlocked something inside of me that, as a storyteller, that I really wanted to tell. And it became my life's work. I didn't know that this book was, like, a thing and kids have tattoos and it was, like, sold in all these languages. So I had, before I found that out, I had a producer friend find out if the rights were available. They were. I couldn't believe they were because it was so undeniably great. But it's sometimes when you find those things, it's because they're undeniably great for you. So I was like, this is serendipitous. I'm going to keep writing this wave. So I wrote the script on spec. I sat on it for a couple of months, and then I wrote to the author because there wasn't enough traction for me, like the traditional route. So I was like, yo, I did this thing. Can I like come visit El Paso and meet you? So I spent 4 days there. We became really great friends. And at the end of that, he said, these boys were mine and now I give them to you. And I was like crying and all this, like we were both crying. And I was like, fuck, what do I do now? Like, right. Like now I have this thing that's obviously valuable and like people love it. Mm-hmm. How do I make it happen? And so I knew that's where I discovered that Lynn had done the audiobook to Ari and Dante. And I was like, we need to get him involved in some capacity. I met a producer through a film festival who helped me develop the script. So that took like about a year. And then end of 2017, we sent the script to Lynn, didn't hear anything back through managers, agents. And I was like, my whole career and anything that I've done has happened because I've made it happen. So I was like, it was New Year's Day, 2018. And I was like, hey, Lynn, read my script. I tweeted at him.
No.
20 minutes later, he replied. And then 3 months later, he was in LA and agreed to produce the film. I just knew there was a relationship to the property there. Like, I knew.
You just had to get to him. You had to get to him.
I had to get to him. I had, and now I can't get rid of him. No, I don't want him.
And now with the yappity yap all the time, it's
all the great ideas and the great notes. And yeah, no, it's been really cool. And he's been, it's not just like someone throwing their name on it. Like he's been a part of the process since then in like a real way. I met Eva on a pitch and we really connected, but he she's so wonderful. She's another force. You've interviewed of her before.
Yeah. No. Eva's fantastic. We got along.
On set, I was like, oh, I get why you're such a star and you're unstoppable.
So, I know.
Yeah.
No, without question. And with Eva specifically, like when you get to meet these people, sometimes you meet them only on Zoom, but sometimes you get to meet them in person and you go, oh, okay, I get it. I truly get what everybody sees in these people. And Eva, I can't wait to see Flaming Cheetos. That's Flaming Cheetos.
Oh, Flaming Hot. That's Flaming where Hot. I pitched on that. That's where we met. And it's really good. I've seen like snippets of it that she showed me on set. I'm really excited and I think people are going to love it.
I know. I can't wait for that movie as well. And it's really interesting. Well, you're working with Lynn and was there any big lesson you learned from him in his process? In the notes, in the storytelling, how he approaches story or producing, what did you learn?
I learned so much and it's hard to distill that because it's like pieces of information, right? But when we finished, because we were editing while we were in production and I hadn't stepped away from the film at all. And I was literally killing myself to like get it done.
Right.
For what was supposed to be a festival premiere back then. And he got on the phone with me and just told me, you need to step away from the movie. And he was in post for Tick, Tick, Boom at the same time. So he was going through like the same first filmmaker vibes that I was going through. And that really hit me once he said that. And that's what I did. I stepped away from the movie and then we went back into post and everything started to like unlock then. So it was invaluable advice.
It is something that people listening should really understand is that sometimes as artists, we get a little too close to the project.
Yeah.
And we're inside the book and you can't read the book when you're inside the book. You got to pull back and give time to do
it. It was 7 years. It was a 7-year journey from finding the book to like getting to production. So I was entrenched in it and I just like, I will die without this, you know, but it's like, he gave me perspective on that. And I was able to come back to it with fresh eyes, with an open heart, because it was like production, editing, like all at the same time. And so the experience of production, the experience of editing something is completely different. And if you're not stepping away to sort of separate those things, you're not doing your best work.
Yeah, without question. Now, let me ask you, when you're on set and, you know, did you have any problems with the whole first time director, even though you did make a feature, but this is a big jump up from that first 2-day experiment with, you know, major actors. I'm assuming the budget was you know, more than what you did in the first movie.
More than
so did you have...
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Oh. So did you run into a lot of, she's a first time filmmaker. I don't know if we trust, like, I don't know. What did you think?
Before, there was other directors attached to, make this before we got to the point, but I always knew it was my story to tell. So whenever those things would sort of, like, all those false starts happened, I was just like, yeah, because it's supposed to be mine. Through that process, my profile sort of started elevating through the JJs of the world and Lynn's validation and all of that. There was a bit more trust in me when it was time to go to set. And I also had a very clear vision of what I wanted. So I didn't second guess myself too much. But what I did want to do is find partners and collaborators that were more experienced than me and were better at what I do. And that was my director of photography, my production designer, my all the people around me that showed up with so much love. Mm-hmm. Is something that I will never forget and I hope to have on every film. And that was the same thing with the actors. I think people really believed in the story, they believed in me, and they showed up with that with such a willingness. And, you know, I've been told that I ran a firm but warm set, which to me is like a big compliment because we didn't have a lot of time, but like a lot of the work was done in pre-production where everybody knew what we were doing. And I'm always super open to hearing someone's idea in the hopes that it elevates what my thought was. And that's what happened throughout this process.
Did you by any, I know a lot of times when we're, you know, young directors or starting out directors, we get pushback from other people on set, let's say, a grip or a DP or anything like that, the politics of the set. And I had it when I started out, like people were like, what do you know, kid? You know, I'm going to shoot it my way. Did you, I'd imagine you didn't have that because you had so many heavy hitters behind you supporting you. But did anything, like, did you have to deal with
it? Really want all the tea, huh? You want all the gossip, all the cheese.
It's not gossip. The reason I'm asking you is this, and it doesn't have to be on this project, on any project, because filmmakers don't know that that's going to happen on a set and they're not prepared for it and it could destroy a shoot. So I always ask that question of every, almost every director I talk to, I ask that question, especially when they're starting out, because it's something that is not taught in film school and it's not really talked about too much. So without it giving names, I don't want to call anybody out, but just how did you deal with it if it did happen to you?
It did happen. It did happen. It did happen from departments that I didn't think it would happen from. And I think it's twofold, right? It's not just because I'm a first time director. It was because I was also a woman on a set. And to top that off, I was a trans woman on a set. So I think a lot of men have often gotten away with certain behavior on sets that are rooted in misogyny. So there was a dismissive sort of tone where questions were being asked and I was asking for things and they were directed to, say, like my director of photography who was male. And it was like, I think it took a certain level of assertiveness and being from where I'm from, I definitely have that. So, there was a need for that. And it wasn't something that I needed or wanted to access or have to like move with. But it was there. And I'm happy it was there because I wasn't going to let anybody sort of like walk all over me or walk all over my dream. And I also have and had the most amazing producer by my side who just had my back in a real way and was with me every day on set right next to me. And that her name is Valerie Stadler, and she was boots on the ground and she was with me from the very beginning. After I found, so her partnership and her having my back throughout it was just, it was very much necessary because I was able to focus on the work while she dealt with some, you know,
drama.
Yeah.
No, and again, these kind of conversations are important to have in a public forum because it really does help other filmmakers coming up.
I know.
They just don't know it's coming. I had to deal with it being the young guy, the young Latino kid. on a set where I might have been the only Latino on the set. And, you know, I had a first AD just a first AD giving me crap. And I'm like, it's my production company. I hired you. I'm personally writing your check. Get on board or get the hell off my set. These are the kind of things that they're not taught, not talked about.
So yeah, that department was one of them. And I finally landed on one of the most amazing human beings that I've gotten the pleasure to work with. His name is Montez. Mm-hmm. And he will be with me on every picture. And it was the first time in the last week of shooting that I was able to walk away from set and know that everything was being taken care of.
That's
and
awesome.
That I could walk and sit down and do my job. And that I didn't have to sort of like be aware of every aspect of it. Because the person that was supposed to like ride with me wasn't doing their job. And that often leads to like people saying you're difficult but it's not that. I'm like, I pride myself on being a really good collaborator and a really good listener, because I think that's what makes a director. Mm-hmm. But it's sometimes you do have to put your foot down, and it's like you do have to assert what your role is in those situations. And that is definitely one of them.
Listen, when you're coming up, it happens for everybody, every gender, everything. It just happens. When Ridley Scott walks on a set, this doesn't happen now.
Now.
But
it doesn't happen now because he's earned his respect. And like that's, and I've heard story from other directors. My DP like walked all over me and like, I'm disappointed. I was convinced to do this. My this did this. And it's just like, no, if I'm going to make a mistake and there's going to be a horrible review, I want it to be my fault. Do you know what I mean? And not be like, I knew that. My instinct was this, you know? And that's also something that I like advise people who are listening is follow your instincts. They are always right.
Yeah. And I did the exact same thing. I had DPs walk all over me and convince me to do things. And then I'm in post. I'm going, why didn't I get the shot that I wanted? Why didn't I fight harder? And these are just things that as directors, we have to go through. And I think every director goes through that at a one way. Scorsese, Spielberg, all the greats, all the masters, they all went through it at one point or another in their careers, because it's part of the process of becoming.
I will say production was magic. And if I could have lived in production for the entire time, I would have done it.
I was going to ask you about production. It's generally speaking, there's always a day that the entire world's coming down, crashing around us as a director. The camera breaks, we lose a location, an actor doesn't come out of their whatever. Was there a day like that? And what was that? And how did you overcome it on any of your projects, by the way? It doesn't have to be this one.
I think every day was like that on this project, because it was such the timing around it. And like, I've been told not to say how long it is, but it was not enough time. And it was, it made it really hard to sort of like not have room for those situations. But again, everybody really showed up in a real way, passionate. They were so invested in the story. It was really lovely to see. But yeah, there was always fires to put out. And I give the credit to my producer Val for like putting those out before they really got to me.
you hear about the damage later, but you're like, the fires didn't hit me.
That almost happened on a daily basis. And a lot of those fires, there, for example, there the truck. There's a truck in the movie, which is like quintessential to the book.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be this fire red truck. I was pushed into getting this other truck off Craigslist that I knew was the wrong color. And they're like, it's just the photo. It's just the photo. I'm like, it's not. The truck gets there. I'm right. And so like everybody's scrambling to now paint this truck the right color and distress it. They paint it the same color it was, but distressed. This I don't know while it's happening. It's day one. I get to set and my production designer is literally painting and distressing the truck to what I wanted. And I would have never known, because it was perfect. It's exactly what I envisioned. But the rigmarole before then, and they wrapped it. There was like three steps that should have just been one. It was so funny, but also scary. And
it's stressful. This is day one.
I thought it was like, it looks great. And they're like, I'm so happy you think so, because this and this happened.
And this is day one. This is day one.
Literally, we haven't even like shot up. Like, yes, we hadn't started yet.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
That's indeed. These are the kind of stories of things I just love bringing out because, man, even if it's, you know, you think a lot of filmmakers coming up will look at your story and look at your movie and they're like, oh, it's got, you know, Eva and Eugenio and Lin-Manuel's producing it. You must have had caviar every day and sushi and yeah. just and a limo brought you. Like, that's not the reality on yeah. on these shows. It's indie filmmaking. No question.
We filmed in Pomona and I stayed in Pomona in like a Motel 6 the entire time. Because I just want to be, I'm notoriously late to things. That's like my pandemic trauma. So I was like, there's no way I could be late to set. So I like had to stay close. But yeah, there was, we lost an actor the day before shooting.
Of course.
It was all the classic stuff, you know?
And it happens. And it does happen. Is that,
and then
yes.
shooting during COVID too, like added a whole engine. We had to stop production for, we went dark for 2 days because my lead actor got sick. Meanwhile, I was sick the entire time he was, but I was like, I can't be the reason that we shut down. So I was like barreling through. And I remember getting to set, he's like massive fever. He's really young. This is his big first major role. And he's like, I can't do it. And I was like, done. Val got on it. We luckily shut down. We didn't spend too much money in doing that. And we were back up and running again. But everybody was really scared that it was COVID because that would have like ruined everything. But it was just some sort of flu.
Oh, that's a whole other level of crap that we have to deal with to make movies in today's world. It's insane. Now, your film is going to premiere at TIFF, the Toronto Film Festival. I always love asking this question. What was it like getting the phone call?
Oh. it's really emotional. It's yeah, like a really emotional moment because it was post-production was so hard. We had been invited to another film festival where we pulled the movie. And so it was it was painful. As an artist, it was a painful sort of decision to make and have to make. But knowing it was the best thing for me in the film. So when this one came, that's also like such a reputable film festival that I haven't been to. And mm-hmm. I'm so excited to be included. It was an exhale. It was like I had been waiting 7 years to exhale and it had happened because it felt really real for the first time.
It's a beautiful festival. I've been there. I was there once and it's a beautiful festival. And Toronto is a great, great city. It's not Sundance. Like Sundance is a whole other experience because I love Sundance, but it's different and it's beautiful. And it's such, and they love their filmmakers. They really, really do. And it's one of the, arguably the top five, if not the top three, one of the top three festivals in the world. So yeah. It's, you know, when you're coming up as a filmmaker, I have to imagine that you had the same dreams that all of us do. It's like, I want to get into Sundance. I want to get into Toronto. I want people to look at my work and tell me that I've done a good job. You want to feel that as a creative, as an artist. And to be accepted into a festival like Toronto is just monumental, especially at the beginning of your career. You're just like, oh my God. Like And it doesn't seem like, and you've been, and being so young, obviously, but you've done a few things in your life that I feel that it's not going to go to your head. And it's not going to be like, I am of the great, that was in the first movie. Like my genius, Hollywood, come and get me.
I mean, that's something that I reflect on often. It's like, there was so much desperation and sort of anxiety when I was younger of having that break.
Right.
That never came. And I think it was for many reasons. I think like I had to like unlock something in me to sort of like be ready to exist in the world authentically and allow good things to happen to me. And once I did that, that happened. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's true for this as well. It's just like, I'm happy it didn't happen when it was supposed to happen in my head and that it's happening now because I'm far more present for it. I'm aware when I'm not. And I bring myself back to it because it's like a dream for so many people and I'm living it and I just really want to enjoy it and have fun with it as much as I can.
Enjoy it because it goes quick. goes really quick. So enjoy every second of it. Now, I have to also ask you the question. You got to work with Eugenio and Eva, and this is your first big movie, and you're working with these veteran actors, some of them legendary actors. How did you approach collaborating with them? You know, I mean, because they're both forces of nature, both of those specific.
They really are.
They are forces of nature.
Veronica Falcone as well, who
yes,
his mom, like all three of them, and Kevin Alejandro as well, all four of them have such great careers on television and film. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting question because it felt so seamless to work with these people. And I joked that the Latinx mafia had to show up in order for this movie to get made, because who the fuck is going to finance a film about like two brown boys directed by a trans woman? But it was them who, again, validated my script. It was Lynn, Eugenio, and Eva all stepping up and being like, this story is important and I want to be a part of it. So that validation sort of came in at the beginning of the process. And then working with them was just like a very natural unfolding. And especially with Eugenio, who was like so nervous to step into this role because it was so different from how people know him. And he was so game and trusted me so much. And it was a lot of conversation and a lot of like, just, you know, support and being there for him to make choices that felt scary, but were right. And it's just like, I think his performance in the film is a revelation and something I'm most proud of.
Yeah, and white hair. He looked amazing in
that. That was all him. The hair, like he was so committed and so impassioned, and you see it on screen. And like that's I'm reflecting back and smiling because it was so lovely. And Eva was just a lot of these people were just the roles. They were people that I wrote with in mind, Eva specifically. So she just stepped into it because that's her. She's motherly and she's nurturing and she's like incredible that it was just like easy to sort of like hold their hand and guide them through the process. And they're also veterans.
Isn't it nice working with real actors?
Yeah.
Professional, like
Veronica Falcone as well and Kevin as well. They're like actors from the theater and they like do the work and the preparation.
Right.
Like, I met with both of them and I knew it was them and I didn't want to see anybody else. And it was just like, it's a thing. It's following your instincts. And I'm really proud of those decisions.
Yeah, because I mean, coming up, you work with non-actors or actors who are just starting out and there's egos and there's this and that. And then the moment I got to work with like an Oscar nominated actor I had to work with and he walked on set, I was like, oh, so this is what it's really like.
And everyone's also on their best game, like the crew, like everybody's just like, shit, this is like real now, which I love.
Right, we're not Mickey Mousing around anymore. These are real actors.
They're real actors. These people are gonna see this and that. There is an energy shift, you know, but those two people that are like super massively famous don't carry that around with them, so that also made it easier.
Fantastic. Now I'm gonna ask you a few questions I ask all of my guests. What advice would you give a filmmaker trying to break into the business today?
Don't wait for permission and delusional confidence.
I love that answer. Delusional confidence.
Yeah. No one's going to tell you you're great. And it's often going to feel like you're not great. So you have to delusionally tell yourself you're the best and your voice matters and it needs to be heard. And that's like, even if you like shoot for the stars and like you land somewhere in the middle, it's worth it.
Now, what did you learn from your biggest failure?
I have failures every day, but my biggest failure was not being true to myself, because in order to be true to who you are, you unlock great art. And like Absolutely. Once you do that, that's where like the real sort of, you know, your alignment and your ability to welcome abundanceness and have your mind sort of unencumbered by the thought of failure is where like the real magic starts to happen.
Well, I mean, the delusional confidence of tweeting Lin-Manuel is genius. It's a brilliant story, by the way. I think I haven't heard that one before, though, to be honest with you. How people always like ask me, how did you get Oliver Stone on your show? I go, I tweeted him. And 10 hours later, he's like, I'll be on your show in 2 days. I'm like, oh, okay. And it just...
But it's also like, you know, forgetting that, right? Like, I want to be able to, like, as I progress, to give that back to somebody. And like, even people who are my assistants and stuff, I make sure that I'm like, doing in a way to like, elevate, you know, I don't want a forever assistant.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film industry or in life?
It's the same one that we were just spoken about. It's just like the truth of who you are is so essential to happiness and existing in a way. I tried to make it for so long. And again, it was like this energetic thing of like desperation. And people feel that.
Oh, yeah.
They don't necessarily want to be around that. But once I transitioned, I was able to, I had walked through the thing that was scariest for me since the day I was born. Nothing was ever going to be as scary as that. So it was just like, I'm here, like I'm in this room because you think my writing is good because you've seen my work. Like you know, like that's the most I can offer you. Like everything else is just like, I don't need you, you know?
It's kind of like I always tell people, when I was coming up, it was like I had a cologne called depression, depression, but desperation.
Depression and desperation.
Depression and desperation by Calvin Klein. It was like Jacquard. It stunk. And I used to like, I'd be on a set and you would like run up to the producer and like, hey, I've got this idea. Hey, can you help me? Like, it's just kind of like, help me. And you're like, no, build a relationship. How can I help you? Is there anything I can do for you? And that's what people connect to much more than, I need you to help me. You don't know who I am, but you're famous and big and you have connections. Do you know how many people call me all the time? And like, can you connect me to this guest that you had? No.
No, it doesn't work like that. It just doesn't work like that. And I know that's hard to hear because you think we often mystify the film industry as this like thing that's like away from us. And in order to access it, you need to go through all these steps, right? Because that's what feels right. But everybody's journey is different. There's nothing, everybody's a human and everybody's showing up and trying the best that they can. If you approach it like that and exist as a human of people just, I'm looking for great collaborators and everybody usually is, right? So if you're like approaching it with that sort of energy, you're gonna see the fruits of your labor sort of like come to you a lot easier than if you're just chasing it.
When you sit back and wait for things, and I know it's hard for people listening, but it's something I've learned in my older age. I don't like to date myself.
We don't talk about older young here.
We don't talk about older. But the gray, I actually dye my hair gray on my beard. but the thing I've learned is that when I was chasing and wanting and going after, there is a level of that you need to be able to get up in the morning and hustle. I mean, the whole brand of what I do is hustle. But you also have to be ready to receive when its time is right.
I love that. And it's trust and surrender. That's my motto. Trust and surrender. Trust and surrender. You're doing the work. As long as you're showing up, you're writing. As long as you're like always looking for ideas and not waiting for it to happen, there's a difference between that hustle versus the chase of it.
Right. You read a book that touched you. You wrote a spec script. You reached out to the author.
Exactly.
Connected to that author. And then after that, then the journey started.
Yes. That's it. And I mean, that's like distilled in that, right? So it's just like there was inspired action, but I was not, there was a sureness to this project that like I just knew was mine. And also like a piece of like advice that I've recently discovered is that there's no arrival at anything. You often think when I get into this writer's room, everything's going to like fix itself. When I like make this movie, like like the work keeps going. You want more after that. You aspire for bigger because you were able to accomplish. And if you just like take it as it comes, it's very freeing in a way that allows the desperation to take a back seat.
Without question. And my last question, my dear. 3 of your favorite films of all time.
The Professional.
Oh my God, so good, Leon.
I have a tattoo.
Oh my God, you do. Oh, okay. First of all, we refer to it as Leon. because that's the proper Leon the Professional. But yeah, yes, I saw it in the theater when nobody. I'm a little bit older. I saw it in the theater, walked in, and I just like this French director, and like Luc Besson, who the hell's that? And I walked in, I was like, oh my God, it's one of the most beautiful films ever made, in my opinion.
It's beautiful. It's such a tender relationship and on-screen duo. It's soft, like in a way that, I don't know, I saw myself in it. I love Paper Moon.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful movie.
It's such a beautiful film. Again, it's like father-daughter relationship. And I love Badlands as well.
Oh my God, yes. Yes, Terrence. Also,
Badlands, Virgin Suicides, and Stand By Me were three inspirations for this film.
I could see that. I really, truly could see the influences of that in the film without question. Listen, thank you for being on the show and congratulations on your success. Congratulations on getting into TIFF with this amazing film. And I look forward to seeing what else you come up with. You know, as us Cubans, Cuban filmmakers, we got to keep it going. We got to represent. We got to represent. So I appreciate you.
Thank you. I appreciate it too. A bunch of Cubans from the 305 are descending on Toronto. So I'm very excited. Thank you for making this fun.
I want to thank H so much for coming on the show and sharing her journey with the tribe today. Thank you so much, H. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/233. And if you haven't already, please, please, please head over to screenwritingpodcast.com. Subscribe and leave a good review for the show, or subscribe and leave a review for the show wherever you are listening to this podcast. It truly, truly helps us out a lot in getting this information out to more and more screenwriters, creatives, and filmmakers. Thank you again so much for listening. As always, keep on writing no matter what. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv.